15 minutes ticked away, then 20. Flopping onto my back, I stared slightly cross-eyed at the ceiling, trying to sneak up on my memory and catch it off guard. When that failed to produce results, I tried a more direct approach. I banged my head against my pillow, trying to knock loose an image. A line of dialogue. A scent that might spark ideas. Anything. But it quickly became apparent that rather than anything, I was going to have to settle for nothing. When I'd checked out of the hospital this morning, I was convinced my memory was lost forever. But with my head cleared and the worst of the shock over, I was beginning to think otherwise. I sensed acutely a broken bridge in my mind, the truth on the far side of the gap. If I was responsible for tearing down the bridge as a defense mechanism against the trauma I'd suffered during my kidnapping, then surely I could rebuild it again. I just needed to figure out how. Starting with the color black. Deep, dark, unearthly black. I hadn't told anyone yet, but the color kept streaking across my mind at the oddest moments. When it did, my skin shivered pleasantly, and it was as if I could feel the color tracing a finger tenderly along my jaw, tipping my chin up to face it directly. I knew it was absurd to think a color could come to life, but once or twice I was sure I'd caught a flash of something more substantial behind the color. A pair of eyes. The way they studied me cut to the heart. But how could something lost in my memory during this time cause me pleasure instead of pain? I let go of a slow breath. I felt a desperate urgency to follow the color, no matter where it led me. I longed to find those black eyes, to stand face to face with them. I longed to know who they belonged to. The color tugged at me, beckoning me to follow it. Rationally, it made no sense, but the thought stuck in my brain. I felt a hypnotic, obsessive desire to let the color guide me, a powerful magnetism that even logic couldn't break. I let this desire build up inside me until it vibrated powerfully under my skin. Uncomfortably hot, I wrestled out of my blankets. My head buzzing, I tossed and turned. The intensity of the buzzing increased until I shivered with heat, a strange fever. The cemetery, I thought. It all started in the cemetery. The black night, the black fog, black grass, black gravestones, the glittering black river, and now a pair of black eyes watching me. I couldn't ignore the flashes of black, and I couldn't sleep them away. I couldn't rest until I acted on them. I swung out of bed. I stretched a knit shirt over my head, zipped myself into a pair of jeans, and threw a cardigan over my shoulders. I paused at my bedroom door. The hall outside was quiet except for the reverberating tick of the grandfather clock carrying up from the main level. Mom's bedroom door was not quite shut, but no light spilled from the crack. If I listened hard enough, I could just make out the soft purr of her snoring. I moved silently down the stairs, grabbed a flashlight and house key, and let myself out through the back door, fearing the creaky boards on the front porch would give me away. That, and there was a uniformed officer stationed at the curb. He was there to divert reporters and cameras, but I had a feeling that if I strolled out front at this hour, he'd speed dial Detective Basso. A small voice at the rear of my mind protested that it probably wasn't safe to go out, but I was propelled by a strange trance. Black night, black fog, black grass, black gravestones, glittering black river, a pair of black eyes watching me. I had to find those eyes. They had the answers. 40 minutes later, I'd walked to the arched gates leading inside Coldwater's cemetery. Under the breeze, leaves twirled down from their branches like dark pinwheels. I found my father's grave without difficulty. Shuddering against the damp chill in the air, I used trial and error to find my way back to the flat headstone where it had all begun. Crouching down, I ran my finger over the aged marble. I shut my eyes and blocked out the night sounds, concentrating on finding the black eyes. I threw my question out there, hoping they'd hear. How had I gotten to the point of sleeping in a cemetery after spending 11 weeks in captivity? I let my eyes travel a slow circle around the graveyard. The decaying smells of approaching autumn, the rich tang of cut grass, the pulse of insect wings rubbing together. None of it illuminated the answer I so desperately wanted. I swallowed against the thickness in my throat, trying hard not to feel defeated. The color black, teasing me for days, had failed me. Shoving my hands inside the pockets of my jeans, I turned to go. From the edge of my vision, I noticed a smudge on the grass. I picked up a black feather. It was easily the length of my arm, shoulder to wrist. My eyebrows pulled together as I tried to envision what kind of bird could have left it. It was much too big for a crow, much too big for any bird as far as I was concerned. I ran my finger over the feather's vein, each satiny barb snapping back into place. A memory stirred inside me. "Angel," I seemed to hear a smooth voice whisper, "you're mine." Of all the ridiculous, confusing things, I blushed. I looked around just to make sure the voice wasn't real.
"I haven't forgotten you."
With my posture rigid, I waited to hear the voice again, but it faded into the wind. Whatever flicker of memories it left behind dived out of reach before I could grasp them. I felt torn between wanting to fling the feather away and the frantic impulse to bury it where no one would find it. I had the intense impression that I'd stumbled across something secret, something private, something that could cause a great deal of harm if discovered. A car revved into the parking lot just up the hill from the cemetery, blaring music. I heard shouts and spurts of laughter, and I wouldn't have been surprised if they belonged to people I went to school with. This part of town was dense with trees, far from the hub of downtown, and made a good place to hang out unsupervised on weekends and nights. Not wanting to stumble across anyone I knew, especially since my sudden reappearance was being splashed across local news, I tucked the feather under my arm and speed-walked along the gravel path leading back to the main road. Shortly after 2:30 a.m., I let myself inside the farmhouse and, after locking up, tiptoed upstairs. I stood, indecisive, in the middle of my bedroom a moment, then hid the feather in my middle dresser drawer, where I also stashed my socks, leggings, and scarves. In hindsight, I didn't even know why I'd carried it home. It wasn't like me to collect scrappy items, let alone tuck them inside my drawers. But it had sparked a memory. Stripping off my clothes and stretching out a yawn, I turned toward bed. I was halfway there when my feet came to a halt. A sheet of paper rested on my pillow, one that hadn't been there when I left. I whipped around, expecting to see my mom in the doorway, angry and worked up that I'd sneaked out. But given everything that had happened, did I really think she would simply leave a note upon finding my bed empty? I picked up the paper, realizing that my hands were shaking. It was lined notebook paper, just like I used in school. The message appeared to have been hastily scribbled in black Sharpie. "Just because you're home doesn't mean you're safe." Chapter 4. I crumpled the paper, flinging it at the wall out of fear and frustration. Striding to the window, I rattled the lock to make sure it was secure. I wasn't feeling gutsy enough to open the window and have a look out, but I cupped my hands around my eyes and peered into the shadows stretched across the lawn like long, lean daggers. I had no idea who could have left the note, but one thing was certain. I'd locked up before leaving, and earlier, before we'd headed upstairs for the night, I'd watched my mom walk through the house and check every window and door at least 3 times. So how had the intruder gotten in? And what did the note even mean? It was cryptic and cruel. A twisted joke? Right now, that was my best guess. Down the hall, I pushed on my mom's bedroom door, opening it just far enough to see inside. "Mom?" She sat up ramrod straight in the darkness. "Nora, what is it? What happened? A bad dream?" A pause. "Did you remember something?" I clicked on the bedside lamp, suddenly fearful of the dark and what I couldn't see. "I found a note in my room. It told me not to fool myself into believing I'm safe." She blinked against the sudden brightness, and I watched her eyes absorb my words. Suddenly, she was wide awake. "Where did you find the note?" she demanded. I was nervous about how she'd react to the truth. In hindsight, it had been a terrible idea. Sneaking out? After I'd been abducted? But it was hard to fear the possibility of a second abduction when I couldn't even remember the first. And I'd needed to go to the cemetery for my own sanity. The color black had led me there. Stupid, unexplainable, but nonetheless true. "It was under my pillow. I must not have noticed it before bed," I lied. "It wasn't until I shifted in my sleep that I heard the paper crinkle." She pulled on her bathrobe and jogged to my bedroom. "Where's the note? I want to read it. Detective Basso needs to know about this right away." She was already dialing on her phone. She punched in his number from memory, and it occurred to me that they must have worked closely together during the weeks I was missing. "Does anyone else have a key to the house?" I asked. She held her finger up, signaling for me to wait. Voicemail, she mouthed. It's Blythe, she told Detective Basso's message system. Call me as soon as you get this. Nora found a note in her bedroom tonight. Her eyes cut briefly to mine. It may be from the person who took her. I've had the doors locked all night, so the note had to have been placed under her pillow before we got home. He'll call back soon, she told me, hanging up. I'm going to give the note to the officer out front. He might want to search the house. Where's the note? I pointed at the crumpled paper ball in the corner, but I didn't move to pick it up. I didn't want to see the message again. Was it a joke, or was it a threat? Just because you're home doesn't mean you're safe. The tone suggested a threat. Mom flattened the paper on the wall, ironing out the wrinkles with her hand. This paper is blank, Nora, she said. What? I walked over for a closer look. She was right. The writing had vanished. I hastily flipped the paper over, but the backside was also blank. It was right here, I said, confused. It was right here. You might have imagined it. A projection of a dream, Mom said gently, drawing me against her and rubbing my back. The gesture didn't do anything to comfort me. Was there any way I might have invented the message? Out of what? Paranoia? A panic attack? I didn't imagine it. But I didn't sound so sure. It's okay, she murmured. Dr. Howlett said this might happen. Said what might happen? He said there was a very good chance you'd hear things that aren't real. Like what? She regarded me calmly. Voices and other sounds. He didn't say anything about seeing things that aren't real, but anything could happen, Nora. Your body is trying to recover. It's under a lot of stress and we have to be patient. He said I might hallucinate? Shh, she commanded softly, taking my face between her hands. These things might have to happen before you can recover. Your mind is doing its best to heal, and we have to give it time, just like any other injury. We're going to get through this together. I felt the sting of tears, but I refused to cry. Why me? Of all the billions of people out there, why me? Who did this to me? My mind was spinning in circles trying to point a finger at someone, but I didn't have a face, a voice. I didn't have one shred of an idea. Are you scared? Mom whispered. I looked away. I'm angry. I crawled into bed, falling asleep surprisingly fast. Caught in that woozy, topsy-turvy place between awareness and a full-on dream, my mind aimlessly wandered down a long, dark tunnel that narrowed with each step. Sleep, blissful sleep. And given the night I'd had, I vigorously welcomed it. A door appeared at the end of the tunnel. The door opened from within. The light inside cast a faint glow, illuminating a face so familiar it almost knocked me over. His black hair curled around his ears, damp from a recent shower. Sun-bronzed skin, smooth and tight, stretched over a long, lean body that towered at least 6 inches over me. A pair of jeans hung low on his hips, but his chest and feet were bare, and a bath towel was slung over his shoulder. Our gazes locked, and his familiar black eyes bored into mine with surprise, followed by instant wariness.
What are you doing here?
He said low. Patch, I thought, my heart beating faster. It's Patch. I couldn't remember how I knew him, but I did. The bridge in my mind was as broken as ever, but at the sight of him, little pieces snapped together. Memories that put a swarm of butterflies in my stomach. I saw a flash of sitting beside him in biology, another flash as he stood very close, teaching me how to play pool. A white, hot flash as his lips brushed mine. I'd been searching for answers, and they'd led me here. To Patch. I'd found a way to get around my amnesia. This wasn't merely a dream, it was a subconscious passageway to Patch. I now understood the great feeling crashing around inside me that never seemed satisfied. On some deep level, I knew what my brain couldn't grasp. I needed Patch. And for whatever reason, fate, luck, sheer willpower, or for reasons I might never understand, I'd found him. Through my shock, I somehow found my voice. You tell me. He stuck his head out the door, looking down the tunnel.
This is a dream. You realize that, don't you? Then who are you worried followed me? You can't be here. My words came out stiff, frozen. Looks like I found a way to communicate with you. I guess the only thing left to say is I'd hoped for a cheerier reception. You have all the answers, don't you? He steepled his fingers over his mouth, all the while his eyes never wavered from my face.
I'm hoping to keep you alive.
My mind lagged, unable to understand enough of the dream to read a deeper message. The only thought pounding through me was, I found him. After all this time, I found Patch. And instead of matching my excitement, the only feeling he harbors is cold detachment. Why can't I remember anything? I asked, swallowing the lump in my throat. Why can't I remember how or when or why you left? Because I was sure that was what had happened. He'd left. Otherwise, we'd be together now. Why haven't you tried to find me? What happened to me? What happened to us? Patch hung his hands on the back of his neck and closed his eyes. He went deathly still, except for the tremble of emotion that rippled under his skin. Why did you leave me? I choked. He straightened.
You really believe I left you?
That only thickened the lump in my throat. What am I supposed to think? You've been gone for months, and now when I finally find you, you can barely look me in the eye.
I did the only thing I could. I gave you up to save your life.
His jaw worked, clenching and unclenching.
It wasn't an easy decision, but it was the right one.
Gave me up? Just like that? How long did it take you to make your decision? 3 seconds? His eyes turned cold with recollection.
That's about as long as I had, yes.
More pieces snapped together. Someone forced you to leave me? Is that what you're telling me? He didn't speak, but I had my answer. Who forced you to leave? Who scared you that much? The Patch I knew didn't run from anyone. The pain bursting inside me forced my volume higher. I would have fought for you, Patch. I would have fought.
And you would have lost. We were surrounded. He threatened your life, and he would have made good on that threat. He had you, and that meant he had me, too.
He? Who is he? I received another brittle silence. Did you even try to find me once? Or was it that easy? My voice caught. To let me go. Whipping the towel off his shoulder, Patch flung it aside. His eyes flared, his shoulders rising and falling with every breath, but I got the feeling his anger wasn't directed at me.
You can't be here, he said, his voice rough. You have to stop looking for me. You have to go back to your life and make do the best you can. Not for me, he added, as if guessing my next resentful barb. For you. I've done everything to keep him away from you, and I'm going to continue doing everything I can. But I need your help.
Like I need your help? I shot back. I need you now, Patch. I need you back. I'm lost, and I'm scared. Do you know I can't remember one single thing?
Of course you know, I said bitterly, as realization dawned.
That's why you haven't come looking for me. You know I can't remember you, and it lets you off the hook. I never thought you'd take the easy way out. Well, I haven't forgotten you, Patch. I see you in everything. I see flashes of black, the color of your eyes, your hair. I feel your touch. I remember the way you held me. I trailed off, too choked up to continue.
It's better if you don't know, Patch said flatly. That's the worst explanation I've given you yet, but for your own safety, there are things you can't know.
I laughed, but the sound was thick and anguished. So this is it. He closed the distance between us, and just when I thought he'd draw me against him, he stopped, holding himself in check. I exhaled, trying not to cry. He leaned his elbow on the door jamb just above my ear. He smelled so devastatingly familiar, of soap and spice, the heady scent bringing back a rush of memories so pleasurable, it only made the current moment that much more difficult to bear. I was seized by the desire to touch him, to trace my hands over his skin, to feel his arms tighten securely around me. I wanted him to nuzzle my neck, his whisper to tickle my ear as he said private words that belonged only to me. I wanted him near, so near, with no thought of letting go. This isn't over, I said. After everything we've been through, you don't get the right to brush me off. I'm not letting you off that easily.
I wasn't sure if it was a threat, my last stab at defiance, or irrational words spoken straight from my splintered heart.
I want to protect you, Patch said quietly.
He stood so close, all strength and heat and silent power. I couldn't escape him, now or ever. He'd always be there, consuming my every thought, my heart locked in his hands. I was drawn to him by forces I couldn't control, let alone escape.
But you didn't.
He cupped my chin, his touch unbearably tender.
Do you really think so?
I tried to pull free, but not hard enough. I couldn't resist his touch, back then, now, or ever.
I don't know what to think. Can you blame me?
My history is long, and not much of it is good. I can't erase it, but I'm determined not to make another mistake. Not when the stakes are this high. Not when it comes to you. There's a plan in all this, but it's going to take time.
This time he gathered me into his arms, stroking hair off my face, and something inside me broke at his touch. Hot, wet tears tumbled down my cheeks.
If I lose you, I lose everything, he murmured.
Who are you so afraid of?
I asked again. Resting his hands on my shoulders, he tilted his forehead against mine.
You're mine, Angel, and I won't let anything change that. You're right, this isn't over. It's only the beginning, and nothing about what lies ahead will be easy.
He sighed, a tired sound.
You're not going to remember this dream, and you won't be coming back. I don't know how you found me, but I have to make sure you don't do it again. I'm going to erase your memory of this dream. For your own safety, this is the last you'll see of me.
Alarm shot through me. I pulled away, flinching at Patch's face, horrified by the determination I found there. I opened my mouth to protest, and the dream crashed down around me, as though made of sand. Chapter 5. I woke up the following morning with a kink in my neck and a distant memory of strange, colorless dreams. After showering, I buttoned myself into a zebra print shirt dress and pulled on cropped tights and ankle boots. If nothing else, at least I appeared put together on the outside. Smoothing out the mess on the inside was a bigger project than I could tackle in 45 minutes. I breezed into the kitchen to find Mom making old-fashioned oatmeal in a pot on the stove. It was the first time I could remember since my dad's death that she'd made it from scratch. Following last night's drama, I wondered if this fell in the ballpark of a pity meal.
"You're up early," she said, and paused in her slicing of strawberries near the sink.
"It's after 8," I pointed out. "Did Detective Basso call back?" I tried to act like I didn't care what her answer was and got busy brushing non-existent lint off my dress.
"I told him it was a mistake. He understood."
Meaning they'd agreed that I'd hallucinated. I was the girl who cried wolf, and from now on, everything I said would be brushed off as an exaggeration. Poor thing, just nod and humor her.
"Why don't you head back to bed, and I'll bring up breakfast when it's finished?"
Mom suggested, resuming her slicing. "I'm fine. I'm already up."
"Given everything that's happened, I thought you might want to take things easy. Sleep in, read a good book, maybe take a nice long bubble bath."
I couldn't remember my mom ever suggesting I play it lazy on a school day. Our typical breakfast conversation usually included rushed exchanges along the lines of, "Did you finish your essay? Did you pack your lunch? Is your bed made? Can you drop off the electricity bill on your way to school?"
"How about it?" Mom tried again. "Breakfast in bed. Doesn't get better than that."
"What about school?"
"School can wait."
"Until when?"
"I don't know," she said lightly. "A week, I guess. Or two. Until you're feeling back to normal."
Clearly, she hadn't thought this through. But in just a few short seconds, I had. I might have been tempted to take advantage of her leniency, but that wasn't the point.
"I guess it's good to know I have a week or two to get back to normal."
She set down the knife.
"Nora."
"Never mind that I can't remember anything from the past 5 months. Never mind that from now on, every time I see a stranger watching me in a crowd, I'll wonder if it's him. Better yet, my amnesia is all over the news, and he must be laughing. He knows I can't identify him, and I guess I should be comforted that because all the tests Dr. Howlett ran came back fine, just fine, probably nothing bad happened to me during those weeks. Maybe I can even make myself believe I was soaking up rays in Cancun. Hey, it could happen. Maybe my kidnapper wanted to set himself apart from the pack, do the unexpected, and pamper his victim. The truth is, normal might take years. Normal might never happen. But it's definitely not going to happen if I lounge around here watching soaps and avoiding life. I'm going to school today, end of story. I said it matter-of-factly, but my heart did one of those dizzy spins. I pushed the feeling aside, telling myself this was the only way I knew to get any semblance of my life back.
School?
Mom was fully turned around now, the strawberries and oatmeal long forgotten. According to the calendar on the wall, it's September 9th. When my mom said nothing, I added, "School started 2 days ago." She pressed her lips together in a straight line. I realized that. Since school is in session, shouldn't I be there?
Yes, eventually.
She wiped her hands on her apron. It looked to me like she was stalling or debating her word choice. I wished that whatever it was, she'd just spit it out. Right now, hot argument felt better than cool sympathy. "Since when do you condone truancy?" I said, prodding her.
"I don't want to tell you how to run your life, but I think you need to slow down."
Slow down? I can't remember anything from the past several months of my life. I'm not going to slow down and let things slip even further out of reach. The only way I'm going to start feeling better about what happened is by reclaiming my life. I'm going to school, and then I'm going out with V for donuts or whatever junk food she happens to crave today. And then I'm coming home and doing homework. And then I'm going to fall asleep listening to Dad's old records. There's so much I don't know anymore. The only way I'm going to survive this is by clinging to what I do know.
A lot changed while you were gone.
You think I don't know that?
I didn't mean to keep pouncing on her, but I couldn't understand how she could stand there and lecture me. Who was she to give me advice? Had she ever been through anything remotely similar?
Trust me, I get it. And I'm scared. I know I can't go back, and it terrifies me. But at the same time,
how was I supposed to explain it to her when I couldn't even explain it to myself? Back there was safe. Back then, I was in control. How was I supposed to jump forward when the platform beneath my feet had been yanked out?
She blew out a deep, frazzled breath.
"Hank Miller and I are dating."
Her words drifted through me. I stared at her, feeling my forehead crease in confusion.
"Sorry, what?"
"It happened while you were gone." She braced a hand on the counter, and it looked to me like it was the only thing holding her up.
"Hank Miller?"
For the second time in days, my mind was slow to throw a net around his name.
"He's divorced now."
"Divorced? I was only gone 3 months."
"All those endless days of not knowing where you were, if you were even alive. He was all I had, Nora."
"Marcy's dad?" I blinked at her, bewildered. I couldn't seem to push through the haze strung ear to ear inside my brain. My mom was dating the father of the only girl I'd ever hated. The girl who'd keyed my car, egged my locker, and nicknamed me Nora the Hora?
"We dated, in high school and college, before I met your dad," she added hastily.
"You?" I said, finally pushing some volume into my voice. "And Hank Miller?"
She started speaking very quickly. "I know you're going to be tempted to judge him based on your opinion of Marcy, but he's actually a very sweet guy. So thoughtful and generous and romantic."
She smiled, then blushed, flustered. I was outraged. This was what my mom was doing while I was missing?
Right.
I snatched a banana from the fruit bowl, then headed for the front door.
"Can we talk about this?"
Her bare feet thumped on the wood floor as she followed after me.
"Can you at least hear me out?"
Sounds like I'm a little late to the let's talk it over party.
"Nora!"
"What?" I snapped, spinning around. "What do you want me to say? That I'm happy for you? I'm not. We used to make fun of the Millers. We used to joke that Marcy's attitude problem was mercury poisoning due to all the expensive seafood their family eats. And now you're dating him?"
"Yes, him. Not Marcy."
"It's all the same to me. Did you even wait until the ink on the divorce papers was dry? Or did you make your move while he was still married to Marcy's mom? Because 3 months is awfully fast." I don't have to answer that.
Apparently realizing how red in the face she was, she composed herself by kneading the back of her neck. Is this because you think I'm betraying your dad? Believe me, I've already tortured myself enough, questioning if anything short of eternity is too soon to move on. But he would have wanted me to be happy. He wouldn't have wanted me to mope around feeling sorry for myself forever.
Does Marcy know?
She flinched at my sudden transition.
What?
No, I don't think Hank has told her yet. In other words, for the time being, I didn't have to live in fear of Marcy taking our parents' decisions out on me. Of course, when she did figure out the truth, I could guarantee the retribution would be swift, humiliating, and brutal. I'm late for school. I rummaged through the dish on the entryway table. Where are my keys?
They should be in there.
My house key is. Where's the Fiat key? She applied pressure to the bridge of her nose.
I sold the Fiat.
I directed the full weight of my glare at her.
Sold it? Excuse me?
Granted, in the past I'd expressed just how much I hated the Fiat's peeling brown paint, weather-beaten white leather seats, and untimely habit the car's stick shift had of popping out of the shifter. But still, it was my car. Had my mom given up on me so quickly after my disappearance that she'd started hawking my belongings on Craigslist?
What else? I demanded.
What else did you sell while I was gone?
I sold it before you went missing,
she murmured, eyes lowered. A swallow caught in my throat, meaning once upon a time I'd known she'd sold my car, only I couldn't remember it now. It was a painful reminder of just how defenseless I really was. I couldn't even conduct a conversation with my mom without looking like an idiot. Rather than apologize, I flung open the front door and stomped down the porch steps. "Whose car is that?" I asked, coming up short. A white convertible Volkswagen sat on the cement slab where the Fiat used to reside. From the look of it, it had taken up permanent residence. It might have been there yesterday morning when we'd pulled in from the hospital, but I'd hardly been in the frame of mind to soak up my surroundings. The only other time I'd left the house was last night, and I'd gone out through the back door.
"Yours."
"What do you mean, mine?" I shielded my eyes from the morning sun as I glowered back at her.
"Scott Parnell gave it to you."
"Who?"
"His family moved back to town at the beginning of summer."
"Scott?" I repeated, thumbing through my long-term memory since the name provoked a vague recollection. "The boy in my kindergarten class? The one who moved to Portland years ago?" Mom nodded wearily. "Why would he give me a car?"
"I never got the chance to ask you. You disappeared the night he dropped it off."
"I went missing the night Scott mysteriously donated a car to me. Didn't that set off any alarm bells? There's nothing normal about a teenage guy giving a car to a girl he hardly knows and hasn't seen in years. Something about this isn't right. Maybe the car was evidence of something and he needed to get rid of it. Did that ever cross your mind?"
"The police searched the car. They questioned the previous owner. But I think Detective Basso had ruled out Scott's involvement after hearing your side of the night's events. You'd been shot earlier, before you went missing. And while Detective Basso originally thought Scott was the shooter, you told him it was..."
"Shot?" I shook my head in confusion. "What do you mean, shot?" She closed her eyes briefly, exhaling.
"With a gun."
"What?" How had V left this out?
"At Delphic Amusement Park." She shook her head. "I hate even thinking about it," she whispered, her voice breaking. "I was out of town when I got the call. I didn't make it back in time. I never saw you again, and I've regretted nothing in my life more.
Before you disappeared, you told Detective Basso that a man named Rickson shot you in the funhouse. You said Scott was there, too, and Rickson also shot him. The police looked for Rickson, but it was like he vanished. Detective Basso was convinced Rickson wasn't even the shooter's real name."
"Where was I shot?" I asked, my skin crawling with an unpleasant tingle. I hadn't noticed a scar or any indication of a wound.
"Your left shoulder." It seemed to pain my mom just to say it. "The shot was in and out, hitting only muscle. We are very, very lucky." I tugged my collar down over my shoulder. Sure enough, I could see scar tissue where the skin had healed. "The police spent weeks looking for Rickson. They read your diary, but you'd ripped out several pages, and they didn't find his name in the rest of it. They asked V, but she denied ever having heard his name. He wasn't in the records at school. There was no record of him at the DMV. I ripped out pages in my diary. I cut in. It didn't sound like me at all. Why would I do such a thing? Do you remember where you put the pages, or what they said? I shook my head absently. What had I gone to such great lengths to hide? Mom made a deflated sound. Rickson was a ghost, Nora, and wherever he went, he took all the answers with him. I can't accept that, I said. What about Scott? What did he say when Detective Basso questioned him? Detective Basso put all his energy into hunting down Rickson. I don't think he ever spoke to Scott. The last time I talked to Lynn Parnell, Scott had moved on. I think he's in New Hampshire now, selling pest control. That's it? I said in disbelief. Detective Basso never tried to track down Scott and hear his side? My mind cranked at full speed. Something about Scott wasn't sitting right. According to my mom's account, I told the police he'd been shot by Rickson, too. He was the only other witness that Rickson existed. How did that fit with the donated Volkswagen? It seemed to me that at least one crucial piece of information was missing. I'm sure he had a reason for not talking to Scott. I'm sure he did, too, I said cynically. Like maybe he's incompetent. If you'd give Detective Basso a chance, you'd see he's actually very sharp. He's very good at his job. I didn't want to hear it. What now? I said tersely. We do the only thing we can. Do our best to move on. For one moment I pushed aside my doubts of Scott Parnell. There was still so much to deal with. How many other hundreds of things was I in the dark on? Was this what I had in store? Days upon days of humiliation as I relearned my life? I could already envision what would be waiting for me inside the walls of school. Discreet looks of pity. The awkward averting of eyes. The shuffling of feet in drawn-out silences. The safe option of shying away from me altogether. I felt indignation boil up inside me. I didn't want to be a spectacle. I didn't want to be the object of rabid speculation. What kinds of shameful theories involving my abduction had already spread? What did people think about me now? If you see Scott, be sure to point him out so I can thank him for the car, I said bitterly. Right after I asked him why he gave it to me in the first place. Maybe you and Detective Basso are convinced he's innocent, but too many things about his story aren't adding up. Nora, I thrust my hand out. Can I have the key? After a moment's pause, she unhooked a key from her own keychain and laid it in my palm. Be careful. Oh, not to worry. The only thing I'm in danger of is making a fool of myself. Know of any other people I might smack into today and not recognize? Fortunately, I remember the way to school. And would you look at that? I said, tugging open the car door and dropping inside. The Volkswagen is a 5-speed. Good thing I learned how to drive 5-speed pre-amnesia. I know now isn't the best time, but we've been invited to dinner tonight. I met her eyes coldly. Have we? Hank would like to take us to Coopersmith's to celebrate your return. How thoughtful of him, I said, ramming the key into the ignition and revving the engine. By the noisy sputtering, I assumed the car hadn't budged since the day I'd vanished. He's trying, she called above the whine of the engine. He's trying really hard to make this work. I had a snide retort on the tip of my tongue, but decided to go for more impact. I'd worry about the repercussions later. What about you? Are you trying to make it work? Because I'll be up front. If he stays, I go. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to figure out how to live my life again. Chapter 6. At the high school, I found a parking space at the back of the student lot and hiked across the lawn to a side entrance. I was running late, thanks to the fight with my mom. After peeling away from the farmhouse, I'd had to pull to the side of the road for 15 minutes just to calm down. Dating Hank Miller. Was she sadistic? Out to ruin my life? Both? One glance at my mom's pilfered BlackBerry proved I'd missed all but the tail end of first period. The dismissal bell would ring in 10 minutes. Intending to leave a message, I dialed V's cell. Hello? That you, Angel? She promptly answered in her best temptress's voice. She was trying to be funny, but I nearly tripped. Angel. The mere sound of the word caused heat to lick up my skin. Once again, the color black raced furiously around me like a hot ribbon, but this time there was more. A physical touch so real, I stopped in my tracks. I felt an enticing brush along my cheekbone, as if an invisible hand caressed me, followed by a soft, utterly seductive pressure against my lips.
"You're mine, Angel, and I'm yours. Nothing can change it."
"This is crazy," I muttered out loud. Seeing the color black was one thing, but making out with it was taking it to a whole nother level. I had to stop haunting myself this way. If I kept it up any longer, I was genuinely going to doubt my sanity.
"Come again?" V said.
Parking, I covered up quickly. "All the good spots are taken."
"Guess who has PE first hour? This is so unfair. I start the day off perspiring like an elephant in heat. Don't the people who make up our schedules understand body odor? Don't they understand frizzy hair?"
"Why didn't you tell me about Scott Parnell?" I asked evenly. We'd start there and work our way forward. V's silence hung sharp between us, only confirming my suspicions. She hadn't given me the whole story. Intentionally.
"Oh, yeah, Scott," she faltered at last. "About that."
"The night I disappeared, he dropped an old Volkswagen off at my house. That detail slipped your mind last night, did it? Or maybe you didn't think it qualified as interesting or suspicious? You're the last person I would have expected to give me a watered-down version of what led to my kidnapping, V." I heard her chewing her lip.
"I might have omitted a few things."
"Like the fact that I was shot?"
"I didn't want to hurt you," she said in a rush. "What you went through was traumatic. More than traumatic. A million times worse. What kind of friend am I if I just heap it on higher?"
"And?"
"Okay, okay. I heard Scott gave you the car, probably to apologize for being a chauvinistic pig."
"Explain."
"Remember in middle school how our moms always taught us that if a boy teases you, it means he likes you? Well, when it came to relationships, Scott never outgrew seventh grade."
"He liked me." I sounded doubtful. I didn't think she'd lie to me again, not when I'd just confronted her, but clearly my mom had gotten to her first and brainwashed her into thinking I was too fragile for the truth. This sounded like a beat-around-the-bush answer if I'd ever heard one.
"Enough to buy you a car, yeah."
"Did I have any contact with Scott the week before I was kidnapped?"
"The night before you disappeared, you snooped around in his bedroom. But you didn't find anything more interesting than a wilted marijuana plant."
Finally, we were getting somewhere. What was I looking for?
"I never asked. You told me Scott was a whack job. That was all the evidence I needed to help you bust in."
I didn't doubt it. V never needed a reason to do something stupid. Sad thing was, most of the time, I didn't either.
"That's all I know," V insisted. "I swear it, up and down."
"Don't hold out on me again."
"Does this mean you forgive me?"
I was irritated, but much to my dismay, I could see V's point in wanting to protect me. "It's what best friends do," I reasoned. Under other circumstances, I might even have admired her for it, and in her shoes, I probably would have been tempted to do the same. We're square. Inside the main office, I expected to have to talk myself out of a tardy slip. So I was surprised when the secretary saw me approaching and, after completing a double take, said,
"Oh, Nora! How are you?"
Ignoring the buttery sympathy in her tone, I said, "I'm here to pick up my class schedule."
Oh my, so soon! Nobody expects you to jump right back into things, you know, hun. Some of the staff and I were just talking this morning about how we thought you should take a couple of weeks to..."
She struggled for an acceptable word, since there was no right word for what I had ahead of me. Recover? Adapt? Hardly.
Acclimate!
She was practically flashing a neon sign that read, "What a pity, poor girl, I'd better use my kid gloves with this one." I propped an elbow on the counter and leaned close. "I'm ready to be back, and that's what matters, right?" Because I was already in a bad mood, I tacked on, "I'm so glad this school has taught me not to value any other opinion but my own." She opened her mouth, closed it. Then she went to work paging through several manila folders on her desk.
"Let me see. I know I've got you in here somewhere. Ah, here we are."
She pulled a sheet of paper from one of the folders and passed it over to me. "Everything look okay?" I scanned my schedule. AP US History, Honors English, Health, Journalism, Anatomy and Physiology, Orchestra, and Trig.
Clearly, I'd had a death wish for my future self when I'd registered for classes last year. "Looks good," I said, throwing my backpack over my shoulder and pushing through the office door. The hall outside was dim, the overhead fluorescent lights casting a dull gleam on the waxed floors. In my head, I told myself, this was my school. I belonged here. And even though it was jarring every time I reminded myself I was now a junior, despite the fact that I couldn't remember finishing sophomore year, eventually the strangeness would wear off. It had to. The bell rang. In an instant, doors everywhere opened and the hall flooded with the student body. I fell into step with the current of students fighting their way to the restrooms, locker bays, and soda machines. I kept my chin tilted slightly up and leveled my gaze straight ahead, but I felt the eyes of my classmates when they looked my way. Everyone took a surprised second look. They had to know I was back by now. My story was the highlight of local news. But I supposed seeing me in the flesh cemented the fact. Their questions danced front and center in their curious stares. Where was she? Who kidnapped her? What kinds of icky, unspeakable things happened to her? And the biggest speculation by far? Is it true she can't remember any of it? I bet she's faking. Who just forgets months of their life? I fingered through the notebook I'd been hugging to my chest, pretending to search for something highly important. "I don't even notice you," the gesture implied. Then I threw back my shoulders and faked a look of indifference, maybe even aloofness. But under it all, my legs were shaking. I hurried down the hall with only one goal driving me forward. Pushing my way inside the girls' bathroom, I locked myself in the last stall. I dragged my back down the wall until I was sitting on my bottom. I could taste bile rising in my throat. My arms and legs felt numb. My lips felt numb. Tears dripped off my chin, but I couldn't move my hand to wipe them away. No matter how hard I squeezed my eyes shut, no matter how dark I forced my vision, I could still see their leering, judgmental faces. I wasn't one of them anymore. Somehow, without any effort on my own, I'd become an outsider. I sat in the stall several minutes longer until my breathing calmed and the urge to cry faded. I didn't want to go to class, and I didn't want to go home. What I really wanted was the impossible. To travel back in time and get a second chance. A do-over. Starting with the night I disappeared. I'd just climbed to my feet when I heard a voice whisper past my ear like a cold current of air. "Help me." The voice was so small, I almost didn't hear it. I even considered the possibility that I'd invented it. After all, imagining things was all I was good for lately. "Help me, Nora." At my name, goosebumps popped out on my arms. Holding still, I strained to hear the voice again. The sound hadn't come from inside the stall. I was alone in here. But it didn't appear to have come from the larger area of the bathroom, either.
"When he finishes with me, it will be like I'm dead. I'll never go home again."
This time the voice sounded much stronger and more urgent. I looked up. It seemed to have floated down from the ceiling vent. "Who's there?" I called up warily. At the lack of a reply, I knew this had to be the start of another hallucination. Dr. Howlett had predicted it. My thoughts turned anxious. I needed to remove myself from the setting. I had to distract my current train of thought and break the spell before it overtook me. I reached for the door lock when a sudden image burst across my mind, eclipsing my sight. In a terrifying twist of scenery, I could no longer see the bathroom. Instead of tiles, the floor under my feet became concrete. Overhead, metal rafters crisscrossed the ceiling like giant spider legs. A row of truck bay doors ran along one wall. I'd hallucinated myself inside a warehouse.
"He sawed off my wings. I can't fly home," the voice whimpered.
I couldn't see who the voice belonged to. There was a stripped light bulb overhead, illuminating a conveyor belt at the center of the warehouse. Aside from it, the building was empty. A drone reverberated all around as the conveyor belt turned on, a clanging, mechanical noise carried out of the darkness at the end of the belt. It was carrying something toward me. "No," I said, because it was the only thing I could think to say. I swept my hands in front of me, trying to feel the bathroom stall door. This was a hallucination, just like my mom had warned. I had to push through it and find a way back to the real world. All the while, the awful, metallic scraping grew louder. I backed away from the conveyor belt until I was pressed up against a cement wall. With nowhere to run, I watched as a metal cage rattled and clanged out of the shadows, moving to the edge of the light. The bars glowed a ghostly electric blue. But that wasn't what seized my attention. A person was hunched inside. A girl,
bent to fit the confines of the cage, her hands grasping the bars, her blue-black hair tangled in front of her face. Her eyes peered through the screen of hair, and they were colorless orbs. There was a length of rope emitting the same eerie blue light tied around her neck.
Help me, Nora.
I wanted to run for an exit. I was afraid to try the bay doors, fearing they'd only lead me deeper into the hallucination. What I needed was my own door, one I created right now that I could escape through to the inside of the school bathroom.
Don't give him the necklace!
The girl shook the bars of the cage fiercely.
He thinks you have it. If he gets the necklace, he can't be stopped. I won't have a choice. I'll have to tell him everything.
My skin was damp at my lower back and my underarms. Necklace? What necklace? There is no necklace, I told myself. Both the girl and the necklace are wild concoctions of your imagination. Force them out. Force them out. A bell shrilled. Just like that, I was jolted out of the hallucination. The keyed-up door of the bathroom stall was inches from my nose. Mr. Sarif sucks. BL plus JF equals love. Jazz band rocks. I reached a hand out, tracing the deep grooves. The door was real. I slumped in relief. Voices carried into the bathroom. I flinched, but they were normal, happy, chatty. Through the door crack, I watched three girls line up in front of the mirrors. They fluffed their hair and touched up their lip gloss. We should order pizza and watch movies tonight, one of them said.
No can do, girls. It's just me and Susanna tonight.
I recognized the voice as belonging to Marcy Miller. She was in the middle of the lineup, tidying her strawberry blonde side ponytail, pinning it in place with a pink plastic flower.
You're ditching us for your mom? Ouch.
Yes, deal with it, Marcy said. The two girls on either side of Marcy made a big show of pouting. Odds were they were Addison Hales and Cassie Sweeney. Addison was a cheerleader like Marcy, but I'd once overheard Marcy confess that the only reason she was friends with Cassie was because they lived in the same neighborhood. Their bond was due to the simple fact that they could afford the same lifestyle. Peas in a pod. A very affluent pod.
Don't even start, Marcy said,
but the smile in her voice clearly stated she was flattered by their disappointment.
My mom needs me. Girls' night out.
Is she, you know, depressed? The girl I believed to be Addison asked.
Seriously?
Marcy laughed.
She got to keep the house. She's still a member of the yacht club. Plus, she made my dad buy her a Lexus SC10. It's so cute. And I swear, half the single guys in town have already called or stopped by.
Marcy ticked each item off on her fingers so fluidly it made me think she'd been rehearsing this speech.
She is so beautiful, Cassie sighed.
Exactly. Whoever my dad hooks up with will be a major downgrade.
Is he seeing anybody?
Not yet. My mom has friends all over. Somebody would have seen something. So,
she transitioned with a gossipy voice,
did you guys see the news about Nora Gray?
My knees went a little soft at the mention of my name, and I flattened a hand to the wall for support.
They found her in the cemetery, and they're saying she can't remember anything, Marcy went on. I guess she's so messed up, she even ran from the police. She thought they were trying to hurt her.
My mom said she was probably brainwashed by your kidnapper, Cassie said.
Like some skeezy guy could have made her think they were married.
Ew, they all said in unison.
Whatever happened, she's damaged goods now, Marcy said. Even if she says she can't remember anything, she knows what happened subconsciously. She's going to be dragging around that baggage for the rest of her life. She might as well wrap herself in yellow tape that says, "Stay out and do not cross."
They giggled. Then Marcy said,
"Back to class, girlies. I'm clean out of late passes. The secretaries keep locking them in their drawers, whores."
I waited long after they had filed out, just to be sure the bathroom and halls would be empty. Then I hustled through the door. I speed-walked all the way to the end of the hall, shoved through the outside exit, and broke into a jog toward the student parking lot. I flung myself inside the Volkswagen, wondering why I'd ever believed I could waltz back into my life and expect to pick up right where things had left off. Because that was exactly it. Things hadn't left off. They'd moved on without me. Chapter 7.
I prepped for dinner with Hank and my mom by changing into flats and a billowy bohemian dress that fell above the knee. It was nicer than Hank deserved, but I had an ulterior motive. Tonight's goal was twofold. First, make my mom and Hank wish they'd never invited me. Second, make my stance on their relationship crystal clear. I was already mentally rehearsing my discourse, which I'd deliver on my feet at top volume, and it would end when I doused Hank with his own glass of wine. I intended to usurp Marcy's diva queen throne tonight. My own propriety be damned. But first things first. I had to lull Mom and Hank into believing I was in the right frame of mind to be taken into public. If I exited my bedroom foaming at the mouth and dressed in a black love sucks tee, my plan would never get off the ground. I'd spent 30 minutes in the shower, hot water beating every inch of my body, and after vigorously scrubbing and shaving, I'd pampered my skin with baby oil. The tiny cuts crisscrossing my arms and legs were healing fast, as were the bruises, but both shed a crack of unwanted light on what life had been like during my abduction. Combined with the filthy skin I'd arrived at the hospital with, my best guess was that I'd been held deep in the woods. Somewhere so remote it would have been impossible for a passerby to stumble across me. Somewhere so godforsaken that my chances of escaping and surviving would be next to nothing. But I must have escaped. How else could I explain making it back home? Adding to this speculation, I envisioned the dense forests spanning northern Maine and Canada. Though I had no evidence to prove I had been held there, it was my best guess. I'd escaped, and against all odds, I'd survived. It was my only working theory. On my way out of my bedroom, I hesitated in front of the mirror long enough to scrunch my hair. It was longer now, falling halfway down my spine, with natural caramel highlights thanks to summer's sun. I'd definitely been someplace outdoors. My skin held a kiss of bronze, and something told me I hadn't been hiding out in a tanning salon all those weeks. I had the aimless thought to buy new makeup, then scratched it. I didn't want new makeup to match the new me. I just wanted the old me back. Downstairs, I met Hank and my mom in the foyer. I vaguely noted that Hank looked like a life-size Ken doll, with icy blue eyes, a golden skin tone, and an impeccable side part. The only discrepancy was Hank's lithe build. In a brawl, Ken would have won, hands down. "Ready?" Mom asked. She was all dressed up, too, in lightweight wool pants, a blouse, and a silk wrap. But I was more aware of what she wasn't wearing. For the first time, her wedding band was missing, leaving a pale stripe around her ring finger. "I'll drive separately," I said brusquely. Hank squeezed my shoulder playfully. Before I could squirm away, he said, "Marcy is the same way. Now that she has her license, she wants to drive everywhere." He raised his hands as if offering no argument. "Your mother and I will meet you there." I debated telling Hank that my wanting to drive separately had nothing to do with a piece of plastic in my wallet, and a lot more to do with the way being around him made my stomach roll. I swiveled to face my mom. "Can I have money for gas? Tank's low." "Actually," Mom said, aiming a "help me with this" look at Hank, "I was really hoping to use this time for the three of us to talk. Why don't you drive with us, and I'll give you money to fill up the car tomorrow." Her tone was polite, but there was no mistaking. She wasn't offering me a choice. "Be a good girl and listen to your mother," Hank told me, flashing a perfectly straight, perfectly white smile. "I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to talk at dinner. I don't see the big deal in driving by myself," I said. "True, but you're still going to have to ride with us," Mom said. "Turns out I'm all out of cash. The new cell phone I bought you today wasn't cheap." "I can't pay for gas with your credit card?" But I already knew her answer. Unlike V's mom, my mom never loaned me her credit card, and I didn't have the moral flexibility to borrow it. I supposed I could have used my own money, but I'd taken a stand and I wasn't backing down now. Before she could shoot me down, I added, "Or what about Hank? I'm sure he'll spot me $20. Right, Hank?" Hank tipped his head back and laughed, but I didn't miss the lines of irritation forming around his eyes. "You've got quite the negotiator on your hands, Blythe. Instinct tells me she didn't inherit your sweet, unassuming nature." Mom said, "Don't be rude, Nora. Now you're making a big deal out of nothing. Carpooling for one night isn't going to kill you." I looked at Hank, hoping he could read my mind. "Don't be so sure." "We'd better get going," Mom said. "We have reservations for 8 and don't want to lose our table." Before I could roll out another argument, Hank opened the front door and motioned my mom and me out. "Ah, so that's your car, Nora.
The Volkswagen? He asked, looking across the driveway. Next time you're in the market, stop by my dealership. I could have hooked you up with a convertible Celica for the same price.
It was a gift from a friend, Mom explained.
Hank let out a low whistle. That's some friend you've got.
His name is Scott Parnell, Mom said. Old friend of the family.
Scott Parnell, Hank mused, dragging a hand over his mouth. The name rings a bell. Do I know his parents?
His mom, Lynn, lives over on Deacon Road, but Scott left town over the summer.
Interesting, Hank murmured. Any idea where he ended up?
Somewhere in New Hampshire. Do you know Scott?
Hank dismissed her inquiry with a shake of his head. New Hampshire is God's country, he murmured appreciatively. His voice was so smooth it instantly grated. Equally as irritating was the fact that he could have passed as Mom's younger brother, really and truly. He had facial hair, a fine scruff that covered most of his face, but where I could see, he had excellent skin tone and very few wrinkles. I'd considered the possibility that my mom would eventually start dating again, and maybe even remarry, but I wanted her husband to look distinguished. Hank Miller came off as a frat boy hiding under a shark gray suit. At Coopersmith's, Hank parked in the rear lot. As we climbed out, my new cell phone chirped. I'd texted V my new number before leaving, and it appeared she'd received it.
Babe, I'm at your house. Where are you?
I'll meet you inside, I told Mom and Hank. Text, I explained, jiggling my cell. Mom sent me a black look that said, make it fast, then took Hank's arm and let him escort her toward the restaurant doors. I keyed in a response to V. Guess where I am?
Clue?
She texted back. Swear you won't tell a soul?
You have to ask?
I reluctantly texted, at dinner with Marcy's dad.
What?
My mom is dating him.
Traitor! If they get married, you and Marcy
could use a little consolation here.
Does he know you're texting me?
V asked. No, they're inside. I'm in the parking lot, Coopersmith's.
The pimp? Too good for Applebee's, I see.
I'm going to order the most expensive thing on the menu. If all goes well, I'm going to throw Hank's drink in his face, too.
Ha! Don't bother. I'll come pick you up. We need to hang out. Been too long, dying to see you.
This sucks so bad, I texted back. I have to stay. Mama's on the warpath.
Turning me down?
Paying family dues. Cut me some slack.
Did I mention I'm dying to see you?
Me too. You're the best, you know that, right?
Word.
Meet at Enzo's tomorrow for lunch, noon?
Deal.
Hanging up, I crossed the gravel parking lot and let myself inside. The lights were dim, the decor masculine and rustic, with brick walls, red leather booths, and antler chandeliers. The smell of sizzling meat overwhelmed the air, and the TVs over the bar blared the day's sports highlights. My party just came in a minute ago, I told the hostess. The reservation is under the name Hank Miller. She beamed. Yes, Hank just came in. My dad used to golf with him, so I know him really well. He's like a second father to me. I'm sure the divorce has just devastated him, so it's really nice to see him dating again. I recalled Marcy's earlier comment that her mom had friends everywhere. I prayed Coopersmith's wasn't on her radar, fearing how fast news of this date might travel. I guess it depends on who you ask, I mumbled. The hostess's smile turned flustered.
Oh, how thoughtless of me. You're right. I'm sure his ex-wife would disagree. I shouldn't have said anything. Right this way, please.
She'd missed my point, but I left it alone. I followed her past the bar, down a short flight of steps, and into the sunken dining area. Black and white photos of famous mobsters hung on both brick walls. The tabletops were constructed from old ship hatch covers. Rumor had it the slate floor had been imported from a ruined castle in France and dated back to the 16th century. I made a mental note that Hank was fond of old things. Hank rose from his chair when he saw me approach. Ever the gentleman. If only he knew what I had in store for him.
Was that V texting you?
Mom asked. I dropped into a chair and propped up the menu to obstruct my view of Hank. Yes.
How is she?
Fine.
Same old V, she teased.
I made a consenting noise.
The two of you should get together this weekend, she suggested.
Already covered. After a moment, my mom picked up her